Europe is complicated. At what point does a question become a statement? Previously in Europe, answers. Hello, everyone. We're doing a special episode where we take your questions and turn them into answers via some sort of EU-approved algorithm.
EU-approved?
EU-approved.
Ah, okay. I don't know what that means, but okay, sure. We just launch into this?
Yeah, pretty much. It's probably the best way to do it. We got some questions. We were meant to do this episode earlier. Sorry we didn't do it earlier, but we're doing it now. Hooray. We got questions from emails and Facebook, so that was good. And yeah, we've broken up into three sections. So first section, EU level questions. Questions about the European Union.
Yeah. What even is a European Union?
This will take too long. Skip that question.
That's just a question from me.
All right, so we got a question on Facebook. What kind of federalism do you guys prefer? Mm-hmm. I think we've, I don't know, I've let my slightly federalist leanings leak a couple of times on episodes / on the Facebook group. So, yeah, I think I've made it very clear that I like federalism. Hugh, are you in favor of EU federalism in any way, or...?
Yes, I think so in a lot of ways. I think it would have been more difficult to argue for without with the UK as part of the EU, but I think without it, it probably is like a way to go in the future in terms of like something that could actually legitimately work and would solve a lot of problems. But I think the issue you would end up having quite quickly is the problem you have in the states, like the United States of America, where you end up, in order to come up with some system that at the time seems like a good way of protecting smaller states' interests, you end up with something that's very unproportional, and then it becomes very difficult to argue in the future for it once you do the mathematics on it. But it's the only way of getting it through in the first place is some sort of guarantee that says, well, as a state, you have these rights as, like, an individual, like, unit. And then it's like, well, is it unfair that states have, like, a disproportionate numbers of in some sort of, like, two-chambered system? Or the system you have in the EU now, where people... There is a very valid complaint of the EU, which is... In a lot of ways, the EU isn't democratic. So, like, the counter to that is often, oh, but, when the UK was the main, people complaining about that was, yeah, well, as comparison to your system, it's incredibly democratic. But on another level, they're also not wrong. There's a lot of things about the EU that are democratic only if you look at it on the level of, oh, but as if you consider each EU member as, like, a unit and they deserve a certain amount of power... regardless of their size, does become a bit of like, ooh, yeah, it actually is disadvantageous being in one of the bigger countries in some cases. In some cases, it's not. And there's the argument the other way of like, oh, as a small country, you've no voice. But as a small country, you still have veto powers. So like, I guess the classic is in the US, you have their Senate, where a senator from a very small state that got elected with very few people comparatively,
has equal power to someone from a massive state who has like a massive like democratic mandate. It's an interesting one, and to be honest, I don't think there's a lot of ways around that.
I think it's a core problem of federalism, and that's not really fixable in a non like in a way. I think the Swiss system again seems very good on paper, but I think if you applied it to hundreds of millions of people, it would quite quickly become like, I can quite easily work out my vote is only worth this proportion of these, like someone from this country's vote and vice versa. Which I think is a core problem. And it's a problem that is irreconcilable. And I've tried thinking about this. And I don't really know. I can't come down hard either way. There are so many advantages, but then you do end up with the... can it ever be proportional?
So my thoughts on like federalism is that there's a couple of countries we should look at in terms of federalism that make sense for Europe, and then other countries that we should probably pay less attention to because they don't make a lot of sense. Yeah. So like the United States is a good one. I think I remember at a party once, a friend of ours actually approaching me and saying, watching the EU over time, I can now understand why the US has so many weird systems in place.
Yeah, and like caveats on existing systems and stuff.
Yeah, so, like you can understand, like looking at the EU from inception to where it is now, you can understand like how a system that seems so unfair, like the Electoral College, could come into place.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I would argue, but I would also argue that in the English-speaking world, we put a lot of attention on the United States because they are the most dominant federation within the English-speaking world. They're the most dominant country, full stop, in the English-speaking world, but also the most dominant federation. Like, very few people look at Australia or Canada, which are, like, English-speaking federations as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like a... It becomes a scale thing, whereas I think in the US, the reason it's an interesting case is because you really do have the situation where you have states that are so enormous and so populous that they're bigger than, like, a large chunk of the world's countries, and then you have states that are, like, way, way smaller than... they're smaller than, like, the likes of Ireland and small EU countries... Yeah. And then you have like, if you do have that, that's the kind of disparity you would end up with. That's the scale of disparity you would end up with on the EU, where you would have states that were 3 million people and you would have states that are 80 million people.
What's the population of Malta?
Yeah, exactly. It's like 2 million or it's, 2.2
It's not
something.
Even in the millions, it's in thousands, I think.
Is it? Okay, well then it's, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Same with Luxembourg as well.
And Iceland would be smaller than Malta if they ever joined.
Yeah, so that's and that's the same thing. That's the same problem you have in the States, and that like the whole thing that was like re-brought up in very like clear numeric terms during the hurricane in Puerto Rico was bigger than half the states in terms of population. And it's like, wait, but Puerto Rico only has 3 points. Most of the states don't have that many people living in them realistically. And it's very much like that is the problem you would have in Europe unless you convinced the likes of Italy, France, Germany, the like very populous countries as a comparison to the other ones to be split up in some way.
I mean, like that has been floated before by other federalists. They go the Europe of regions.
Yeah,
is the argument where like they make the argument that why should Catalonia report to Madrid if Madrid's only going to report to Europe? Like, why just remove? You could just remove the middleman.
I think the problem you have then is like it's very easy to argue for specifically talking about like EU federalism. It's easy to argue for it as a thing that exists on top of, as supplementary to your national government, and because then you don't have to deal with the problem of people who don't want to get rid of, who like the way their national government works and don't want to get rid of it, or like don't want to have it lose too much power. But then, which is like why the EU largely works the way it does now, and also why it's so popular, is that. It doesn't feel in most countries, like Britain excluded, it doesn't have enormous chunks of the population arguing that it's too restrictive and has too much power. If anything, there's more people saying the opposite. Whereas I think if you did start having to split up countries to make it fairer and more proportional, you would end up with because then you'd have to have systems in place where that gets revisited over time, etc.
Because then you'd be like drawing. There's even the people who propose screw the existing borders. Let's just split Europe into like 28 equipopulation states, and like that. That's a bit more like mad fantasy land from my perspective. Because my general view is you're not going to break the national borders as they exist today without the consent of the people within them.
But we've already seen that as a problem of with Kurz's government offering passports to people in the
in South Tyrol.
Yeah, in the German-speaking bit of Italy. And you're like, well, that's obviously making the Italian government angry, because they're like, well, we finally agreed borders and we made Europe work as... We made peace in Europe over this and you want to change the system?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, so the thing that you need to always come back to with the EU is that the entire, like, a large point of the EU and the thing it's most successful at is there are no more wars in Europe between European countries within the EU borders.
Yes, yeah. Because people were like, I feel like I've made that point before, and then people would throw like Ukraine and the Yugoslav wars at me in my face. It was like, I feel like you're disengaginously not engaging with my point.
Yeah,
because
it's
not like there's no more wars in Europe in general.
Within the EU borders, there aren't other countries starting wars with each other.
Yeah.
Germany hasn't invaded Poland once the entire time.
We're very proud of them. I think the thing to remember is that if federalism happens in Europe, it's probably going to be the German style of federalism.
Yes.
Because the federations currently within Europe are, I think there's only three within the EU, and that's Germany, Austria, and Belgium.
That are technically federations.
Are technically federations. Yeah, you can make argument that Spain is a federation and everything but name, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. And I might be wrong. There might be another country that's a federation that I'm not thinking of. But yeah, in the same way that the European Parliament currently operates very like the French Parliament,
mm-hmm.
European federalism is going to look very similar to German federalism. I think
you'd quite quickly end up with. Like, we both, I think we've established we both like this as an idea conceptually, and it would probably be the German system. However, I think you would end up relatively quickly with the problems you have in the US and in Switzerland in some ways, in that, like, you could have an idea that has, like, relative support, and then you have a minority veto system set up, effectively.
Yeah.
So if you live in America and you live in California, which is way, way more liberal than most of the country, and you have like a more than population level of support for something, that just can't try it because it would require approval of too many states who disagree with you. And I think if you needed to do something like gay marriage as an example on a EU federal level, if that was the kind of thing that was controlled by the central federal government and required their approval, I think you would end up with vetoes coming from countries where you'd be then suddenly like, oh, this is now affecting something I agree with, and maybe this is too big, and it's too difficult to make a system that works on that level that the majority of people are actually happy with the functioning of. I don't know if it'd be an improvement on the existing system. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do like everything Schultz says, and Schultz says it's a good idea.
So there's like three last things I want to bring up about this like federalism point.
Yeah.
That I think are worthy of consideration.
Mm-hmm.
First is how the EU currently operates with certain very sensitive within the council, which is basically Europe's upper house in a way.
Yeah.
Like if Europe became federal system, that would be the Senate.
Yes.
So if that remains with very sensitive topics when those come to vote, I think it's like matters of defense and economy, mm-hmm. and certain things like that. They used qualified majority voting.
Yeah.
And what that is you need 55% of the member states,
mm-hmm.
who also represent 65% of the EU population.
Yeah, which is similar to the way the canton voting in Switzerland works. It's like you need, I think that's like you need, for something to pass, you need a majority of people individually voting, and you need a supermajority of cantons. So you need 2/3 of the cantons. The proportions of that might be messed up, but it's some, like, it's quite similar to that.
That's when they hold referendums.
Yes.
The referendum needs to pass by like simple majority amongst the people, but also needs to have, like, it needs to win, like a supermajority of the cantons.
Yes, I think that's like,
you can't that's, scrape by in all that's, cantons.
That's theoretically how the U.S. Senate's supposed to work, but it's not, because they've changed the rules so many times that you can get straight majorities for a lot more stuff than you used to be able to.
Yeah. The other side of it is, the other thing to consider is an auxiliary language.
Right.
That's been advocated for in the past, and as far as I know, in polls, Germany is still in favor of making English an official auxiliary language in all EU states.
Yeah. I think in terms of, like, as in, it would be very difficult to have... to have an EU federal system without that agreed on, like some sort of system like that, some sort of setup like that, and it'll probably end up being English just for like a international business applicability point of view.
Yeah.
In terms of like, I think it's just at this at this point in the world, there is probably just too many there's too many multinational corporations who have to interact with EU legislation who operate predominantly in English who would complain otherwise.
Yeah. How are we going to lobby?
Also, weirdly, without the UK as a member, English is probably the fairest one, because you probably have the you've the largest proportion of like people who speak it as their second language from member states. But it's not the main language of any of the large, like, complainy members. Like, as in, it's the main language, spoken language in Ireland. But,
and Malta.
Yeah, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, that's a good point. And Malta. But otherwise, it's the one you'd have the most people with it as a second language, but not... There'd be no one gunning for it in a, like, oh, thank God, it's our primary language way.
Yeah, it's like, you'd get a lot of resistance if... the main auxiliary language became German or French.
Yes, exactly. Just from a purely like, you guys have so much power already, and we don't actually have the diplomatic staff with this already.
Yeah,
en masse. Whereas they would be more likely to have enough English speakers to swing it.
Where it's like that's English is a very pragmatic choice, purely from the point of view of. Like, it is the most spoken language, most spoken second language in Europe. The most spoken first language is German.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, there's loads of systems now. Like, for example, you can't graduate in Spain anymore without like, basic fluency in English.
Oh, why? Really?
Huh. That's the law. Like, it's, that's, like, personal stuff. My sister operates an English language school. In Spain.
Yeah.
And there was a huge boom, largely because that policy was very poorly implemented.
Yeah, probably not enough time left for people.
No, they didn't roll it in. They weren't like starting from people in this year and going forward. They're like, oh yeah, you're 3 years into your 4-year course, you better know English. kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that was pretty bad, but that's now the situation in Spain. It's like a really low requirement. It's like A1 level fluency, which is like really low. But it's still in place, and people are talking about, people look to India, which has introduced both Hindi and English as auxiliary languages.
Yeah.
Because each state in India basically has its own language.
Yes. But yeah, but then you end up, yeah, you do need a common thing.
Yeah. Every driver license in India is either it has the state language on it and then English.
I would be totally fine if it also being German, even though it would require me to relearn German. But it just in terms of you do end up with that covers an awful lot of people, and an awful lot of people in countries that neighbor Germany, which due to Germany's size is a lot of countries. A lot of those people in those countries know German anyway, for like either from school or from like they live near the border, or it's advantageous for them for business reasons, etc.
Then the last little point, and definitely Kieran's number one problem with US federalism, and I actually don't know if this exists anywhere else in the world, but in the US, residents of DC don't get a vote.
Yeah,
unlike lots of things.
That's one of the quirk caveats of the crazy American system.
Which made sense when, like, Washington, D.C. was, like, a swamp that no one lived in. But now it isn't. It's, like, something like the sixth largest city or something ridiculous like that, or sixth largest metropolitan area.
It's bigger than some states.
Yes, yeah.
Not physically bigger, but it's more populous than some states.
Yeah, and then like you look at German federalism, where Berlin is its own state.
Yes, that's the way to do that if you want to say a metropolitan area is a special thing, make it its own state.
Yeah, like I've looked at every other federal system and none of them seem to do what the US does. Like
no.
Brazil's capital is its own state. Like Brussels is its own state within Belgium. Yeah, so none of that nonsense with EU federalism. That would be like one of my wish list things.
Yeah. Anyway.
Next question.
Yes. Oh god, that took a long time.
Sorry. That was a big topic.
Yes.
Question: is the EU democratic enough? Is it too centralized or not centralized enough?
I think methods like attempts to make the EU less centralized have kind of ended up with, you know, pretend non-centralization. Like the whole busing in order to not have Brussels too central, they have they bus everything to Strasbourg and back again. You're like, this probably seemed like a good placating some special like people who are complaining about too much centralization in Brussels, but like you hear people who operate in the Brussels bubble now who have for a long time, who, like, one, they call it the Brussels bubble. Like, that's a funny thing.
Strasbourg bubble.
The EU probably is too centralized on that level. But it's like, they talk about, like, Brussels was much less of a big deal as a city than it is now. And there are advantages of having, like, a central, just from terms of, like, if you want to operate a think tank or a policy research group, or, like, MPs need staff, or MEPs need staff, etc. Like, stuff like that that...
Yeah.
Doesn't like in terms of like where the parliament sits and stuff. I think it's fine. I think methods of having it otherwise, like another way of operating it, would actually just be too expensive. It's not like this idea gets floated like with very little support in the UK, where it's like Westminster as a building keeps needing refurbishments, and it's very old and it's quite problematic for. Theoretically, you could just have multiple chambers and bus everyone up to Manchester and be like, you now operate in Manchester for a few months over the like every alternating 2 or 3 years or something. That's something you could do, but overall, is it worth the expense of decentralizing stuff?
Yeah, like I was actually interesting. I found out that South Korea is actually in the process of moving its capital or its political capital.
Is that for defense reasons?
No, it's actually because South Korea is ridiculously centralized in terms of population.
Yes, yeah, it is. That's
There's
true.
Too many people in Seoul. So they're like, we've made this new city. Like the city always existed, rather, but we're in the process of moving all of our like political buildings and staff and agencies to this city. We've made it its own like special autonomous region. That has a certain level of control over things like taxation to incentivize more people to move there as well.
Yeah.
That was a very interesting concept. But in terms of like centralization, in terms of physical centralization, no. I've been to Brussels and you can actually avoid the EU stuff pretty easily.
Yeah, which I think is people think that the EU, like a lot of the actual stuff that happens relating to the EU isn't stuff that happens like in the parliament, etc. There's like all of the EU agencies are very intentionally spread out, which I think is a good thing. Like I said, because they started working it that way. They weren't like, we're gonna have every EU agency in Brussels and see how it goes. And they're now trying to move it out. It's like they're by design, it's very spread out in terms of where EU agencies have their home and stuff, which is
moving non-essential agencies out of the capital is like based on like the US's success at doing that as well.
Yeah,
is a really good idea. Like the fact that the center of disease control is in Atlanta is like a massive boon to the city of Atlanta in the United States.
One, it's a big employer. Also just in terms of like you do occasionally then get like political conventions and stuff, and it's like it's great for the convention racket, etc., which is true of the EU agencies as well. Like that's a because when they were trying to calculate all the money the UK would lose from losing the drugs agency, for instance. It was like, cool, so it's all the staff directly employed by the drug agency, but then also all the ancillary stuff of, like, lobbying groups that exist purely to lobby the drug agency, which, like, you know, not necessarily pro more lobbyists, but it is an additional thing.
Yeah,
conferences that happen here because they're targeted at people who are employed in the drugs agency. It's like, yeah, lots of stuff that relate to it. And yeah, I think the EU does an okay job at spreading that stuff around. I think it's fine. Again, in terms of, like, when people complain about the EU lording over certain policies and stuff, the EU has a lot fewer... I think if you quizzed most people about what bits of the law does the EU have full control over and what bits can they influence, etc., people would name a lot of things that the EU doesn't have any power to control. And it's like, yeah. Whereas I think there's more of an argument within countries. I think the EU is far more... In the same way, the EU isn't democratic, and it's like, yes, but if you compare it to your government, they are. the EU is too centralized. It's like, well, in some ways, but compared to your country, they're not.
So in the terms of centralization, I don't think it's too centralized. I think actually for some efficiency purposes, like getting rid of Strasbourg. By getting rid of, I mean, like, turn it into a university or a hospital or something, not just, like, blow it up.
Yeah, or make it an EU agency that needs space. I'm sure one of them would kill for an office building.
The suggestion I heard, actually, on EUobserver.com was turn it into the first, like, EU-backed university.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, an international, European university, and I was like, yeah, it's a pretty nice building for it. I don't see why that wouldn't be a problem. But yeah, get rid of Strasbourg. But beyond that, I think it's centralized to a decent extent. It's done a good job of doing things that a lot of other, like, larger countries had to do eventually.
Yeah,
like the
A lot of countries do badly because they end up decentralizing stuff or putting things in places for decentralization reasons, but it ends up creating a much more more inefficient system than you would have had if you had left that thing centralized. So, like, the example I like to use in the UK is to get your national insurance number, which you need to pay tax, like your tax number. It has to be posted to you, which is fine. You know, that's like they have a relatively secure way of doing it. They don't want to change it for fear of messing stuff up, but. For decentralization reasons, the office that posted to you is in Scotland, and not in an area of, so it's in, like, it's kind of a thing that has delays associated with it anyway, but then they acknowledge on top of that, they're like, oh, and the postal delay will be 2 or 3 days on top of that. You're like, wait, where in Scotland is it?
The Isle of Skye, Jesus.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's in one of the big cities. I think it is somewhere.
It's not in Glasgow or Edinburgh.
No, I think the reason it's there is for decentralization, like intentional decentralization, and you could do that in some ways. And they had the same problem in Ireland in the mid-2000s. There was a big push to move things out of Dublin, but then, like, you need to be careful of what bits of it you decentralize, and it's like, are you making that much more inefficient? So, like stuff like the idea of moving the parliament around is you end up with the EU's crazy Strasbourg system, whereas, like, oh, the expense of moving all the individual MEPs isn't that much, but once you factor in all the other stuff on top of it and maintaining this enormous office building and moving all their staff and, like, what's the benefit you're getting other than the symbolic benefit?
Yeah, I also think Brussels was a pretty good symbolic city.
Yeah.
It's a city that's changed hands between countries a handful of times. It had, like, a lot of relevance in terms of, like, the horrors of World War One and Two.
Mm-hmm.
And... It is a multilingual city within a multilingual country.
Yeah.
I think Brussels is a perfectly good symbolic capital, and it makes a lot of sense. Ireland did a pretty bad job at decentralizing, especially with, like, private businesses.
Yes.
Where they would just incentivize massive companies to go into, like, these random places, but never the same place twice.
No.
So basically, there'd just be this town in Ireland where you're held hostage, even some of the major cities where you're held hostage by, like, one employer, essentially.
Mm. Yeah.
So you have a job there, and if you lose it, you have to move to Dublin anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And there's certain places that, like, there is lots of pharmaceutical stuff and nothing else, and you're like, this is good in a way, and you specialize this area, but actually the diversity of employment is quite low. So
yeah, I always thought, like, I'd really love to live in, like, I've always really wanted to live in Cork, Ireland's second largest city. But for IT, you're basically held hostage by, like, Amazon have offices down there.
Dell used to have a lot of stuff there, and that was kind of that, in a lot of ways. It's not that there was nothing else. It was just like, if you lost your job in those places, that's, your choices were very severely limited. Whereas it's
Your choice after that was to move to Dublin.
Yeah, diversity of employment is a very difficult thing to fix anywhere. I don't think it's a problem in the EU necessarily. It's more of a internal to individual countries problem, and it's,
yes,
there's not like a fix-all for it.
No. As for, is the EU democratic enough? There's actually only one real thing I would change about the current structure, which is, I would say, allow MEPs to initiate legislation.
Yes, I think that would be great. Because I think it would actually raise the profile of a lot of MEPs.
Oh, totally, like, the only MEP I think most people would know by name is Guy Verhofstadt.
Yes, and Nigel Farage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. But they actually know him, but don't know him as an MEP.
That's true. Well, I there's so much footage of him in the parliament. There's like Tajani, because he's the, you know,
kind of
the. I think there's that, and I think there needs to. This isn't about making it more democratic, but there needs to be a way to make it more obvious who your MEP is in some way. As in that, like, I constantly forget who mine is. In fact, I've forgotten again.
and it's
partially because you don't really hear about what they're doing, but that's true of like most national parliaments too. But I think there is still a I don't think you need to make the parliament bigger. I think there is some solution that they can come up with, or we could come up with, that wouldn't make it more democratic, but would make it appear more democratic, because it would be more like, oh, you voted for this individual and here's why. I don't know, maybe we'll see.
Yeah, so I'd agree with that. I think the large problem with like EU democracy is a lack of attention. The turnout rates on like EU elections are pretty low, to the point where it's getting a bit ridiculous. And I do think that's largely because a lot of what Brussels does is shouting into a void that no one's paying attention to. Similarly, on top of that, and probably Ciarán's most, I'd say, radical opinion that he's probably willing to share is, I do think EU citizens should get a full vote in any other EU country.
Like, yes. Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think that's an enormous problem. Especially like it's most apparent us living in the UK, because due to other agreements, we have full votes as Irish citizens in the UK elections. But, like, yeah, the amount of people who, like, I know, having only lived here for a few years, the amount of EU citizens I know here who aren't UK citizens and therefore can't vote in general elections, and you're like, a lot of you live in big city centres anyway, and you're probably going to vote for Labour or, like, another relatively left-wing party, so it probably doesn't actually matter that much, because of where you live is kind of a centre for what you think anyway, but you are disenfranchised completely.
Yeah, totally, and, like, the result of that is, the reason UKIP as a party can even exist is because they are attacking people who have no political say.
Yeah, but also, like, they operate generally in places where there actually isn't the immigrant population.
Oh, totally. I'm not saying that this would wipe them out.
No,
The fact that Irish people have a vote is proof. I would use as evidence against anyone who would say, oh, this would destroy a country's like democracy or fabric. It's like, we weren't able to stop the UK from doing a whole bunch of crazy shit.
Yeah, like, even if you look, like, if you look at total numbers of EU people in the UK, they probably still wouldn't have that big an impact, because again, they live in they generally live in like city centers and stuff. It's really just about like how, like, if you didn't agree with your MP, and, you know, it's not even that like, oh well, this system isn't very proportional anyway, but like, I literally have no vote. Like, the rule now is they have to have votes in local elections, but I think like that's, you know,
that's EU mandated.
Yeah, that's only like a part of it. That's really like that's an important part of it, but it's not like you have created a class of disenfranchised people.
Yeah, I've heard people like defend the current system, being like, "Oh yeah, but EU citizens have a vote in local elections." And it's always funny because those are people who come from like Germany and Austria. I was like, "Well, yeah, you think that's great because you exist in a country where your local government is relatively strong, and actually does make an impact."
Yeah, that's a good point.
A local election in Ireland means fuck all.
Yes, and also like it's to the point of like your county council has effectively no control in Ireland, has no control, like no revenue raising ability, and their budget is completely fixed by a body that if you're an EU citizen not from Ireland or the UK, you can't elect the people who decide the budget of the thing you get to vote for. So like a lot of the county councils are completely neutered. It's not even an aspect of their like they have a low amount of power. It's like, no, they have no power because the government gouged their budget, which is true in the UK as well. It's much less true in like if you live in one of the big more federally EU countries. It's different anyway.
That's something we've brought, and that thing seems to be coming around a bit. Like the Greens in Ireland did actually float a bill recently that was like allow EU citizens to vote.
Because again, it would have less effect than people think it would have. I guess there's the flag waving fear of but theoretically, like in our election year, all the French people could move to England and vote in our elections and then leave immediately. Technically, I guess, sort of.
I mean, it would be stupid expensive. And you can would have, any self-respecting French person do that?
You can have a residency requirement on it. You could have like a 2-year residency or something. Or even a low attainable one.
Like most countries have, please be registered with the local authorities. As soon as that happens, then the vote.
But that's often so. As in like in a lot of countries, the registration deadline is sufficiently close to elections because having it further back is you've the fear of disenfranchising people who just forgot to register to vote.
I'm not talking about register for your local, like register as
a resident with local council.
That's a big deal in like Spain and Germany.
Yeah,
that if you're actually, and that's not something people who are on like temporary stays can do. No. You have to have like things like proof of address or proof of employment.
Yeah, that's true. You could do that. That's true. I think that would. Yeah, I think. There would always be an argument of like manipulation on top of that, but I think it would be the benefit would be otherwise you always have the fear of you've created a system where there are people who can't vote and they have no national representation of any description. Even if they live in a country where like you could apply for a postal vote or something, that's not important. It's like local actual parliamentary representation.
And then the other counter example is Luxembourg, in terms of percentage, has the highest EU non-Luxembourg citizens.
Yes.
They're like something like 46% non-Luxembourgian EU citizens, right?
Mm-hmm.
After a while, if your population keeps increasing like that, does your democracy not become a joke?
Kind of thing where
the government is not elected by, like, in any way sense a majority of the population.
Yeah. It's the same thing as saying, like, oh, only landowners can vote. If you've added a stipulation of like only these people who live here can vote, and you're like, that's fine, but you have to acknowledge that your democracy isn't actually a true democracy because there are disenfranchised people in your country who are disenfranchised despite having permanent residency.
Yeah, and then like I think the other more symbolic point is that one of the big events in like liberalism as a dominant ideology was the American Revolution.
Mm.
And one of their rallying cries was no taxation without representation. And that's exactly what we do to EU immigrants.
Yeah.
We tax them, but they don't get representation.
I mean, like how many people would give up their vote if they didn't have to pay taxes?
I figured out how to solve the libertarian problem in the States.
Because that would have been great if during the American Revolution, the response to that was just like, well, that's fine, we'll stop taxing you. It's like, wait, what? Wait, no, yeah, they'll still be like import tariffs and stuff, but we're not going to tax you individually. Wait, what?
We win, I guess?
Oh, we should have had more specific demands.
All right. I think we've kind of answered this to a certain extent. Has the parliament the power it needs, or are the heads of state too powerful?
Maybe.
Again, I would, like we've mentioned earlier, I'm in favor of MEPs being allowed to initiate legislation.
Yeah, I think there's tweaks on the... I think there's a lot of tweaks like that that are actually quite small changes you could make that would, you know, be good, test the waters, try this for a while, see how it works out, revisit the question later things. Because, like, there's a lot of benefits of the way the system works now, and if you made some small changes that gave MEPs a little bit more autonomy and the parliament a bit more power, maybe, but not, like, a lot more power. Because there is, the system is good of heads. I think that in a lot of countries, you would start running into the problems of, like, oh, the MEP makeup and the government makeup are very different in a lot of countries. And if your country's MEPs are, like, pushing stuff through the parliament that your national government really doesn't like, you're kind of like, well, yeah, that's probably not... you probably should, like, have some sort of veto on top of it. But I think you're... I think I like that... Like, your idea there, which I'm not saying you came up with, but
no.
as, like, an example of a couple of smaller changes you could make to make the parliament a little bit more powerful, but not...
I think in the current state of the EU, the states are always going to have the amount of power they do. Anything less or more than that is probably going to be way too problematic.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to really convince people of the idea of federalism before we can start taking away some state rights or, like, state power over the current affairs. Like, the a good example would be remove the Council of the EU, I think it's called, the, like, every 6 months meeting where the heads of state come together and decide what the EU is going to do.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That would be something that you would eliminate in a federal system. But I think in the current system, that's something I think a lot of people actually support if they knew it existed.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And then our last question, our EU level section.
Mm-hmm.
How will the net neutrality situation in the United States, how could it have a knock-on effect in Europe?
Yeah, it's interesting in that I think there is, often it's the other way, like it has in the past been the other way. I think... This is something that I find, like, because, like, I work in technology generally, and you get a lot of, like, on, like, industry message boards and stuff I look at, you get a lot of anytime there's net neutrality discussion, no, sorry, rather, anytime there is something the EU has done that would negatively impact Google or negatively impact Apple, there's always someone who is loudly, like, as a group, like, a vocal minority of people who are very US-centric, who are of the opinion of, oh, well, like, Google might just stop operating in that country or in the EU.
Yeah.
And the response to that immediately is always just like, the EU is as big a market as the US for most of these countries.
Bigger
for a lot of them. Like, for the example, like so for example, like Apple, it's not, and that's because they have a much larger market share of America, but the market they have access to isn't smaller, and it's where... like an enormous proportion of these companies who like sell expensive products or expensive digital services that are out of the price range of a lot of the world. It's not like they can be like, cool, we'll refocus on Africa, because the profit margins there are actually smaller. There's not necessarily less people who will use your product. Yeah. It's that there are less people who can pay the fee that would make it profitable for you to offer that service from America. So like the EU introducing the more restrictive data privacy stuff, there was lots of people who were shouting like, oh, there's like, there'd be serious considerations with a company like Amazon that you'd be like, oh, we're not going to operate a lot of our services in the EU. And it's like, that's crazy. That would be them cutting out half of like almost half of their actual like market, basically.
Yeah.
And it's like their answer to that instead has been to spend a shit ton of money in the EU building data centers out of fear that because Germany already had quite restrictive stuff of you can't move German companies' data out of Germany without their permission. So like companies like Amazon that operate like enormous server businesses, the response was not, oh, we'll restrict the services we sell in Germany. It was, how can we make it that Germans buy our services? Because we need, it's not that they need them to, it's that there's an awful lot of money to be made doing it. So I think the same is true in a lot of, so like often what they end up doing is they don't change the product overall. They just give France or Germany or the EU as a whole a version of the product that is the bare minimum changed for to allow for what they've demanded. So like an example, like again going back to the data privacy stuff of the EU, like they've kind of worked out ways of how can we offer this hosting on EU servers, or how can we mandate it that we'll delete accounts in the way that you say we have to in the for EU accounts, but we don't have to implement it for the US accounts because we like keeping all the data forever, and then we'll just have two versions of the product. So like with net neutrality, I don't know. I think the a possible knock-on would be you would have more services that kind of start off that are smaller in Germany and France especially, and probably Britain as well, that kind of gain more traction in the EU because they don't have problems. They don't have scale problems that you would have if you started off in America.
So it's one of the big things that when this net neutrality stuff was being discussed in the United States was that making these packaged data deals for existing services on the internet kind of favor the existing rulers. So like the idea that like you have infinite data on your phone plan for like texts and calls, but if you want infinite data for Instagram, that will be X amount of money, right?
Yeah.
The problem with that being that most telecom companies aren't going to know about the little guy Instagram competitor that might one day, if given a fair marketplace, replace Instagram because they're better for X reasons.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the knock-on effects. But I think the thing with that is that little guy Instagram competitor will probably now prove itself in Europe first before America starts to pay attention and be like, oh, we'll institute a Floopstagram like package now kind of thing.
The actual actual fear would be that these companies would start to begin with as in it would turn out not to be American companies because they wouldn't be able to grow globally easily because they wouldn't get enough local users first. So it'd be kind of like, while they weren't necessarily first to the market, the German version actually catches on because they were able to dominate Germany while the US one was still trying to like claw its way up due to like not having access to its whole market. But it's like it's interesting. I think it's
that's a fair point that you might have actually handed a something on a silver platter to a lot of other first world economies.
There's already
a fair threat to Silicon Valley from places like London, Berlin, and Tel Aviv. So you might just see that grow, basically.
Or nothing will happen, one or the other.
Because
the whole thing about this is that like the argument of like some conservatives in America is that, oh, we want like an actual version of this that like has more allowances and caveats in it, that isn't like changeable one day randomly by whoever happens to be running the FCC. So like there will probably be some legislative version of net neutrality that has more like allowances for because like basically what a lot of the carriers in America want to do is not implement a really complicated pricing structure, because that would be like, isn't they already have a really complicated pricing structure, and it wouldn't necessarily be like monetarily advantageous for them to do that. They own other services that they want to promote, that they already want to promote. It's not necessarily about like the worst possible version of it, which is that like Google and Amazon and Netflix and etc., are forced to pay extra money to these providers, and therefore no one ever can do anything else. It's that they, a lot of them are like for instance, like Verizon owns Tumblr.
Yeah.
So it's not even about like, oh, the big like protection, the big players that currently exist controlling it. It's not like the telecom companies who control the end part of the user, like user internet pipe and the wireless networks. They just want to be they want to be able to do a zero rating style thing more like on a bigger scale. That's not even necessarily about extracting money from these big companies. It's been like, you know, we want to disrupt this market with a inferior product that is only better because we've said it's better on our network. Because places like Verizon and Comcast, etc., have trouble with, like, they try to release streaming services and stuff that are actually just worse than Netflix and don't do well because of that.
Yeah.
Whereas if they can be like, oh, but it's faster, or it's included for free with this thing, and it's like, it's not antitrust because you told us that the internet isn't a common carrier. You already get a bit of that in the EU. I don't think there's the same danger of it. I don't think it's a knock-on effect of that net neutrality will like not become a thing in the EU anymore. I think it'll be more, you'll end up with some sort of middle version of it in America, and that will have some sort of knock-on effect.
Yeah.
Or nothing might happen. One or the other.
Or nothing. That's always possible. All right, Hugh. Now some questions on a national level. Questions.
Yeah. Yes.
So, question number one. Do you think that opposition forces supporting anti-corruption rules can prevail? This is in reference to the likes of what we've been seeing in Romania, but also the implication being that this is also an issue in other Eastern European countries, quote-unquote Eastern European.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think the Romania, for instance, like the consistent mass protests show that there is an appetite for a certainly a lot less corrupt government than they currently have, and like there is mass popular support for the anti-corruption measures. bless you. I think they can prevail. It's just a matter of when and if this version of them is the one that works. I think there's like long historical backdrops for other places further west being incredibly corrupt, and some of them are still corrupt, but they're less corrupt than they were. I think it's a matter of time thing for a lot of them, and it's very difficult to know whether like this version of the Romanian anti-corruption effort is the one that works, or if like the current generation need to like be gotten rid of or die off a bit before any proper anti-corruption works.
Yeah, so that's true. I remember reading a comparison between Romania and Bulgaria, which were both allowed into the EU on the same caveat of just like, deal with your corruption issues. And they both have anti-corruption agencies, but the difference being is that the public in Romania has a bigger appetite for getting this fixed than the public in Bulgaria. I mean, maybe not bigger appetite, but the public in Bulgaria don't seem to be as mobilized as the Romanian population is. Personally, I would like to see a comparison between, because I think the big two comparisons you can make is like, you have countries like Bulgaria where there doesn't seem to be a huge effort towards fixing this problem. You have Romania where there's like a lot of people on the ground trying to fix this problem. And then the other example I'd be interested in looking at is the likes of the Czech Republic, where the Czech Republic is surrounded by basically an all but like one side by countries that have dealt pretty well or have had longer time to deal with their corruption issues, like Germany and Austria. So I'd be super interested to see if just proximity helps.
Yeah.
Because you have countries that are quite corrupt that are right beside countries that are unapologetically corrupt, like Russia and Belarus.
Yeah, I think that's I think Belarus actually is an interesting example, because it's like there's not like a sign of like regime change soon, for instance.
Oh, no,
but
no,
there
no,
is it's... like a, if you compare what it's like now to what it was like, you know, even 10 years ago, is like there are more concessions from the top than there used to be, certainly for like transparency measures, etc. Not saying that they're making like immense progress, but it's like there is an acknowledgement of a growing proportion of the country being like, why can't we operate like other countries and not have a perpetual ruler who seems to control everything with a money oriented fist?
I think what's happening in Belarus is very interesting, and that's worthy of its own discussion, and probably millions of people have written articles that are better informed than I am. But what I'm seeing, or like what I've seen from the articles I've read, is that Belarus has, while not publicly saying it, the people in charge of Belarus have lost faith or lost their trust of Russia.
Yeah.
Because one of the interesting things that happened after Crimea was, and this is the handy thing about being a dictator, Lukashenko in Belarus very quickly passed a law being like, any unmarked soldiers you see, shoot on sight.
Yeah.
Which,
at that point, you can say like, oh, well, it's not like loads of Russian soldiers everywhere.
So yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, corruption in Eastern Europe, very interesting topic. Next question. This was a little devil's advocacy argument that we were asked to do. Why is Brexit the right thing to do? Is there an argument we can find that we would genuinely support, or seems somewhat more appealing to us?
It's an interesting thing. So, like, now the official stance of the Labour Party is to not support a second referendum. And there's like a real discussion going on, which is like, cool. So if they came out publicly for a second referendum, that would be political suicide, because there are so many people who are like on the fence, Labour supporters, who are Labour supporters and voted for Brexit. And you could say that, well, some proportion of them are people who are like, oh, you know, like maybe I would think about voting for it again. But like, there seems to be polling data that pretty across the board shows that there's a significant portion of Remain voters who also don't support a second referendum, so that like Labour could see like a drop off in their quote unquote momentum from and drop in support from a lot of younger people who wouldn't necessarily be like, I want a second referendum, would take the stance of, wait, are you asking us again because you think we fucked it up the first time? Is that what you're saying? Which is kind of like, well, people obviously don't like being told they failed, but it's also like there is a support for, well, I guess we probably have to do it now. Let's do it in the way that is the best way. And, you know, come up with, can we do it where we're not properly members? Because that seemed to rile up an awful lot of the like, this is the thing, yeah. Being a member of the EU, while I liked it and you liked it, and like a large chunk of the British population liked it, it was like a big one issue voting thing for a lot of people. And like, it really riled up a lot of the population of like, while you could argue like a lot of them were being swayed by disinformation, etc. That doesn't like 100% change the fact that there was a huge number of people who really didn't like the idea of being a member of the EU at all. And they weren't that small a population, and they have a lot of MPs who are like not a controlling proportion of the parliament, but they're not insignificant in that, like, we're talking about like dozens of MPs, not like five or six.
So I think the only argument that I ever found, like, so I kind of agree with probably what I think is happening within Corbyn's Labour, which is, it's done now, let's try to make the best of it type of situation. I do agree with that stance. I don't think having a second referendum would solve anything. My only hope now in terms of maintaining European Union status quo is that they basically end up with a deal that effectively changes nothing. Like they're out of the EU on paper, but then like EU, like British citizens are still allowed to go to other parts of the EU. They become like Norway or Iceland or Switzerland.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I think could happen, but that's not really why is Brexit the right thing to do. That's just like a covering my ass kind of thing. I think the only thing that in terms of like, we need to do Brexit because of this that I found appealing was like, there was a lot of posters for it in Scotland, the Lexit argument. If you ever saw posters for that, which was the left Brexit argument,
right,
which was a small kind of grass movement type of thing that was like alter globalization, like it wasn't like globalization in its current way is not working, it's leaving a lot of people behind.
Yeah, well, this was Corbyn's reason for what we assume he voted to leave.
Yes, yeah,
for this exact reason, in that like exactly, it's a. The EU generally comes down in favor of large corporations. In a lot of things, they rein them in, but there's stuff like there was big fear that they weren't going to renew the license on glyphosate?
Phosphate. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, no, wait, no, the one that's in
the
one, fertilizer.
The fertilizer, which like effectively like means it's like the main fertilizer, but it's, you know, like a... So no, it's a pesticide. It's like the main... Pesticide. It's the main pesticide, and... It's largely control. It's largely one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons why Monsanto has like an enormous control of the EU pesticide market, and like everybody uses it. Basically, it's what's in like Roundup and stuff. But it's like there is a good argument for why you wouldn't want to renew the license for it if we're unsure about the health implications of it, and like there is like very very big uncertainty in the scientific community around whether or not. Using it the way we're using it now is a good idea, but like the EU quite narrowly decided to renew the license for it under kind of the guise of, oh, we're actually not sure it's a problem. But I think this is like an example of you know, it's a continuous stream of things where like, yeah, globalization does seem to win out with a lot of EU decisions, and it would be very difficult to have a leftist wave that control the EU enough to swing it the other way.
Yeah. I'm still optimistic about doing that one day, and that's why I didn't really like the Lexit argument, but I do see the appeal of just like, screw the EU, let's just do that, like, alter globalization in this country.
Yeah, I would find that more appealing if there was any hope, if they didn't live in the UK.
Yes, yeah, because the Tories are the biggest obstacle to that, where it's like they still have massive support and they would be very much against doing anything like that. Yeah,
and absolutely. Also standard of living in the UK is largely down to its association with enormous corporations and large financial services jobs.
Yeah,
most of the, like this is the thing, most of the a lot of people who harken back to, oh, there was enormous like growth in the 80s, and it was like that was pretty much exclusively in financial services.
Yes, it was the Thatcher years and stuff like that. Yeah, it's... Yeah, that would be the only argument that I found appealing. The democracy argument I didn't find appealing because democracy is, despite what most people think of it, is highly subjective. Like, there are ideologies that are in favor of, like, direct democracy, where people get together and discuss things on, like, a local level and working confederations, etc. And they would argue that the system that we have currently is not democratic. So you can always make arguments of more or less democracy. Yes. It's a big giant scale.
I agree with you. I think the more democratic argument for leaving the EU is completely moot in a constitutional monarchy with
where the head of state is picked by God.
And the second chamber is basically completely selected by whoever was last in government, put the most people in, and there's still like hereditary seats in it. There's less than there were, but there's still hereditary seats. There's still seats for the Church of England. It's full of either like business people, old party hacks who would have had to leave politics by now if they weren't made lords, etc. It's kind of, so it was in like the UK in my eye is so undemocratic that any problem you have with the EU, and there are a lot of problems with how the EU is in terms of its representation, etc., isn't reasonable. And it's like, oh, we're being dictated to by France and Germany is like, well, that's nice. You do realize you're being dictated to by the high upper class.
Yeah, so this is like I said, the subjective type of thing of it. Like, because, yeah, you could jump to like different ideologies, like where you have like Marxist-Leninist communism that's just like, no, you just need to vote for one party, it's grand,
yeah,
kind of thing. And you can understand why people in our society would think that's not a real democracy. Mm. But then there's like even just going from one type of country to another.
Yeah.
Like, we come from Ireland, and yeah, we see the UK as not being as democratic because we come from a republic.
Yeah.
But then there are like republics that get to vote for their Senate who would come to Ireland and see Ireland as undemocratic.
You can... Wait, no. You vote for your Senate in Ireland.
No, you don't.
Have you never participated in a Senate election?
God damn it, Trinity alumni.
No, the Senate election's otherwise. It's not all stuff like that, but there are problems with it. In that, you
have... Senate elections.
No, you voted for your senators otherwise. It's not all, like, Trinity and stuff like that. But as in, like, so I have two votes in the Senate. Because I'm an alumnus of a university that for some reason has an extra Senate seat. And again, there are seats in it that aren't, you know... voted in the same way.
Okay, so no, like, okay.
It's...
So in our Senate, there are 60 members.
Yes.
11 are appointed by the Taoiseach.
Yes.
6 are elected by the university graduates.
Yes.
43 are done in Shannon panel elections.
Yes. But
the remaining 43. And that's where 5 panels are formed of candidates who represent vocational interests, namely culture and education, agricultural, labor, industry, and commerce.
Right.
And they select who the remaining 43 is.
Ah.
There's no direct Shannon elections in Ireland.
Oh, well, I get a direct election because I'm a...
You do, because you graduated from one of the universities.
I'm an alumnus of the prestigious university.
But it's not like... I can totally imagine an American citizen coming over to Ireland and saying... Where they get to directly elect for their senators. They also directly elect their judges. And they could say, we're not as democratic.
Only in some places.
In some places. And then, like, you'd have people from Switzerland who would come to America being like, we can start a popular referendum whenever we want, kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. Like, and, like, all those systems have, like, anti-proportional things lobbed on top of them. There's lots of support in America for our Senate is unrepresentative. Because it is.
Yeah.
This is the thing.
Yeah, no,
and, like yeah, on different levels. Okay, sorry. Yeah, but the House of Lords is much worse than anything in the EU in my eyes.
Totally. And then the other argument that was totally like a bit more airy-fairy, and I don't think anyone can really discuss it properly without like a philosophy degree, mm-hmm. is sovereignty.
Yes.
Because like sovereignty is a very liquid term again, where it's like, yeah, the UK has sovereignty and the EU has a certain level of sovereignty, but the sovereignty the EU has is given to you by the UK, and the UK is sovereign, but you're not.
Yeah, no, so the UK isn't sovereign. The Parliament has sovereignty.
Yeah,
which is the difference between a democracy where it's the sovereignty of the nation because the Parliament's power is derived from the people, whereas mm-hmm. in the UK the Parliament's sovereignty is given by the monarchy on yeah. some version of that I'm not explaining very well. But it's like, this is the whole thing of like the uproar of Theresa May wants the Brexit negotiation not to have a final vote in Parliament. It's like, why hand up just being saying, I thought the entire point was that you would make Parliament sovereign again and that it wasn't sovereign because it didn't get final say on every piece of EU legislation. is the core of that argument is like, for a fully sovereign system to exist with the EU is every piece of EU legislation would have to also be voted on by the British Parliament, which it's not. Therefore, British Parliament isn't sovereign. And then you wanted to subvert that because you find it was very inefficient.
Yeah, so that, like... But even... I feel like sovereignty meant a different thing to a lot of different people.
Yes, people viewed it as, like, the EU controls us. And it's like, yeah, but the other system... The system that you're getting isn't that... a direct democracy version of that. It's your parliament, which is technically supposed to represent you, controls everything you do. So they make 100% of the laws with, you know, instead of whatever percentage they make now.
Yeah, and then you can get into like really deep debates about like it's meant to represent you, but how representative is it really? Like you can go into voting things, or then you can talk about like the likelihood of like percentage of people in the parliament who have a college education versus those like in the public who don't, and how much property they own and how much you don't, yeah, and things like that. And so, yeah, the sovereignty argument was always airy fairy at best.
I think going back to the question, I think the overall like why is Brexit the right thing to do is because they had a referendum and people voted in favor for it by a much larger proportion than the anti-Brexit people would like to think they did, in that there was an enormous like actual number of people that would need to have changed their minds completely for the other side to have won. And realistically, I think overall you should have referendums and supermajorities and stuff anyway, which would mean that you would need a much larger people to change the status quo. But I think then you would start running into problems of well, if that had always been the case, like it would have been much more difficult to enter the EU, etc. I think it still would have gone through. I think there was like 70% or something in favor of joining, or last time they had a leaving referendum or something. But like the crux of my point is that they voted for it by the laws that we agreed on, and by we I mean the parliament that we elected.
And by we I mean parliament and no one else.
So like realistically, like what the from here the I respect and think my government is legitimate point of view is, well, they set the rules for the referendum because that's the powers we gave them previously. We voted in favor of leaving, and they're muddling the way trying to figure out how to do it. and like the best outcome really that I would see happening would be some version of a favorable deal that protects most of my interests, and then the UK can get on with replacing the House of Lords and coming up with a new voting system that's in some way not bullshit.
My version of it is we leave the EU, we all go into a dusty haze, and we wake up the next morning and suddenly the monarchy is gone. Like it's something like that.
That'd be great. Well, it would depend what it gets replaced with.
God Emperor Jeremy Corbyn.
No.
He doesn't have long left. He'll be fine.
I don't want that either.
All right, last question on the national level. How is it possible the EU is so well united in Brexit talks?
It's not, is the answer to that question. It appears like it is because almost 100% of the Brexit talk so far, at least the stuff that's been made publicly available, is the EU gives out like an example of how something could work. The UK immediately poo-poos that as like crazy EU overreaching, and they're like, okay, fine, could you give us a suggestion how you think it would work? And the UK refuses to provide a solution that has any details. So like the most obvious example being the some sort of agreement on cash transfer for leaving the EU to cover the UK's expenses that they are already receiving stuff from the EU for. So for instance, like all the science agreements you did before leaving, the pension obligations that you would have because like you've a lot of ex-EU staff that were your staff members or your MEPs, and like do you expect Germany and France and the rest of the EU to pay for their pensions? And the UK are saying, no, that seems reasonable, let's come up with a figure together. The EU suggests a ballpark, the UK say that's too high, and not necessarily in a way of like, oh, we're paying nothing. It's in a, we don't think we'd get that through our parliament, or that would be so publicly unpopular in the UK, we need a lower number. And the EU says, fine, suggest a number, and the UK doesn't give a number in response. So like the reason the EU seems united is because they haven't had to decide anything yet. There's no deal for them to decline.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also think that another thing that's helping is that the EU's position at the moment is just Brexit should happen and with as little damage as possible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there is much disagreement on that. Like the only thing that could really happen to muddy that, I think, is other issues happening in the EU, like spilling into the negotiations, like Poland being like obstructionist for the sake of their own issues with the EU.
Yeah, yeah.
But that wouldn't necessarily be an EU disagreement on the EU, because I don't think Poland holds any kind of different views. I think Poland also thinks Brexit should happen with as minimal damage as possible.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, it's like the from the Polish example, the problem would be out of spite, Poland starts vetoing stuff that comes before them. That's Brexit deals, because they're saying, like it's all about trading horses within the EU. It's not that Poland wants a trade war with the UK.
At the same time, though, that like that's a possibility, but we haven't really seen much of that happening, because I think Poland has probably more aces up its sleeve to deal with this rather than resorting to that.
The consistent, the consistent thing is like everything that we, especially like in the English language media, everything that seems like big Brexit news here, it's all for a domestic audience. Like there's so little substance in it. It's all speculation of things that haven't even been really touched on properly, because the UK has been so difficult with actually suggesting things that are feasible, that there's nothing really in Europe for them to disagree about yet, because there hasn't been a final like number agreed of what this will cost the EU. There is no trade agreement to speak of for people to have trouble with, and when they will, Wallonia in Belgium will immediately start vetoing everything anyway. So I think it's just that we haven't seen the disagreement within the EU yet. I don't think that they're actually united on it. I think it's the exactly as you say, it's the nobody wants trouble.
Yeah, I think it's that. Also, we've seen signs within the EU that they're willing to defer to more affected parties.
Yeah, definitely.
Like we saw with like the Irish border issue, the EU deferred to Ireland.
Yeah.
Being like, Ireland's a part of the EU, what does Ireland think should be done with the border, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see more of that, which also causes, like, reduces the number of potential problems.
Yeah. In a similar way with, like, with Gibraltar, Spain's position on it now is, like, we want to come up with an equitable solution that everyone's happy with. We're willing to be relatively flexible. But if there was a problem created over it, like, which seems absurd if you think about it, there is the appetite in the EU to say, like, if Spain is very unhappy with the agreement, that is a problem with everybody, because we all have our own little thing. And stuff,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like stuff like citizens' rights in the UK for EU citizens, is a pretty like, as in there's enough of those topics that are uniting, because most EU countries have at least some people living in the UK, like some sizable number of people. So it would still be very unpopular within their country to have very restrictive citizen rights. So like, there's a lot of stuff that kind of just affects everyone relatively equally.
Yeah,
it'll be fine. I think we'll see. I think we'll, once there's like trade agreements and actual things to vote on, there'll be more hilarious EU infighting.
Yeah, I'd say 2018 is going to be a big year for it. But if we see more of the EU deferring to countries that are more affected, I think we're actually going to see a lot less of the trouble that I think a lot of people are going to predict.
Yeah.
And now we have two questions dealing with our two favourite countries that control every aspect of our lives, the Twin Engine.
We're being sarcastic.
We are.
So the first one's about Germany.
Yes. Is Merkel going to be able to make the Grand Coalition work again, is the question. So this is just a general, is the Grand Coalition going to work, and what is that going to look like?
My speculation, I'm calling it, is yes. and they will just negotiate some sort of Schultz has appoints the finance minister or something, or Schultz gets some really prominent job personally, or I think there'll be a grand coalition again. Just because like the alternative is no one really wants another election. Like the SDP says they sort of and they would rather do that than
minority government, wasn't it? They said they'd rather do another election over a minority government. I think the Grand Coalition's definitely coming back, and I was looking at the numbers of the previous election versus this election and trying to figure out if there's a difference in power relation. My only thing that the only conclusion I've kind of come to is that so the Grand Coalition will be smaller. One thing that will probably have some effects, because the last Grand Coalition was goddamn massive.
Because the due to the FDP getting basically wiped out. There were very few other big parties.
There was only four parties in the Bundestag last.
Two of them ran everything together. It was great. And that it was very funny because you could basically look at any national parliament and there'd be like the occasional fight, and the German parliament was like the most collegiate thing ever because it was them very much like debating small details of things.
The German parliament seems to be, if we want to put a favorable light on it, undramatic, and you know they get on well together, and I feel like the German priority is the work needs to be done. Like, let's all stop the infighting, etc., etc. The work needs to be done. So I think it will probably go as smoothly as it went last time. The only other difference between the numbers is that the difference between the size of the two parties is now smaller.
Yes, that's an interesting point about it, which is why conceivably they could end up getting, like, they can, it's not that they can ask for more out of it. It's just that, you know, it'll be a different Grand Coalition, but I think it's probably going to happen. I think Merkel particularly doesn't want another election. Also, there's now strong support in Germany for Merkel not being chancellor through the entire parliament. Like by 2020 kind of discussion of like, if Merkel was gone by 2020, that'd be fine. Form a government, run it for a couple of years, leave would be the way to look at it, and kind of go out on a, like, you're not very unpopular personally, but like you've been in power a long time would be, I think, the takeaway from it.
Yeah.
I think that would be not a concession of a new Grand Coalition, but like if Merkel was planning on stepping down at some point, would be buffering a new Grand Coalition.
Wouldn't there also be like a kind of I think you'd also want to step down before you lose an election?
Yes, definitely.
As well. Yeah. So that would be interesting, but I suspect the day to day is going to look very similar to what it was before.
Yes.
Yeah. And now over to France, with our last question of the evening.
Yes.
What's next for France? What is the mood around Macron? From an outsider POV point of view, is his honeymoon... his honeymoon was hilariously short.
Yes. So the thing about this is that, like... That is true. I think it's because, like... Macron personally getting into power was very much like a... on a lot of levels, an anti-Le Pen thing, in that he was pretty popular, but it's not like he was, you know, nearing a majority in the first round or something. It's not like...
Yeah, was he more liked than Le Pen was hated?
Yeah, which is hard to tell, and is kind of... there's a lot of his, like, labor reforms, etc., are things that, like, were very, very unpopular when the socialists were doing them, and, like, you would have ended up with, like, a version of it with conservative... president, but you wouldn't have. It's unclear as to whether like a conservative president would be able to have the sweeping sweep of the parliament like Macron did. So I think it's kind of like a personal popularity of, if you sort of liked Macron and kind of thought he was something he wasn't, like thought he was more liberal due to being young or something, or like kind of like a we've elected this guy, he hasn't made sweeping changes. I was like, it's been a week.
Yeah, he's
I think that's not, I don't think that's unusual for France. We consider like Hollande wasn't like, Hollande became so unpopular, but as in that we don't see, I think in a lot of other countries you see people who like take Trump for example, like he's very unpopular by American president standards at like approval ratings in the 30s, but like Hollande's approval ratings were like in the 10s or so, like they, like by the end of his premiership.
Yeah, he had the lowest approval rating of any sitting president in France.
Yeah, and like if you look at Sarkozy's second term, it was like crazy low numbers. Not second term, Sarkozy's like final year, like as in there was a reason Hollande was able to beat him was because Sarkozy was unpopular, very unpopular. I think you get much harder swings in France, but I think on top of that, like there is now that Macron has like had some successes in the world stage in terms of like profile and like being able to hold his own in negotiations, he's kind of like seen internationally as a, oh well, if Merkel's in a weaker position, we should look to Macron for strength because he actually seems quite good at international diplomacy. A lot of his stuff is kind of actually moving through and getting done in a way that's not. Like,
because he basically controls all the like or his party Republican March controls all the like major houses and like parts of the French government that you need to control to get shit done.
And he's getting a lot of good press of his cabinet members seem very like, for instance, with like labor reforms that he's pushing through, the reason they didn't happen immediately was because he got his ministers to go back and start negotiating with labor unions, and it's one of the reasons why you aren't seeing like saying Macron became very unpopular very quickly, and like from the day he was elected for like a month or two later, and there was that enormous dip. He's seen a recovery. I think it's more that he never really, I don't think you could ever call anything he had a honeymoon period. I think it was just a, cool, you're elected, where's our shit? kind of attitude to it. Whereas I think we expect, the like, honeymoon period that you see in other countries. Again, I think that might be more of a, like, seeping in from American politics.
Yeah, that's fair. I think because the American election ends on such like a high and like it's very ceremonious, but it really is like with Macron, you really do get a sense of like the other options were worse kind of thing rather than the American election, which feels very final and triumphant and stuff. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like I was watching a year in review video of like France this year, and like literally all they had to say about Macron was like, he pushed through the labor reforms and his dog peed on the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, this is the thing about Macron, is that he doesn't... Basically, everything else he does is just, like, a relatively successful outing or a relatively successful meeting with a foreign leader, or, like, there's bubblings of him doing something moderate and generally agreeable by a lot of the population, which doesn't, you know, doesn't. There's a lot of people who are just like, oh, this isn't the leftist sweep I wanted, or this isn't the conservative sweep I wanted. No. This is a weird in between that is unpopular for that reason. But I think I think he's bouncing back, and like numbers relatively support that. It's not like he's getting a big surge.
He's on 46% approval, which, as far as I know, is high for France.
The French are dismissive of their governments.
They are, yes. I think you're right. I think he's going to work well on like an international stage, and he'll also work well with Germany. Mm-hmm. Like the fact is, I think he could work well whether it was Merkel or Schultz.
Yeah.
Like it's going to be Merkel, but people criticize Hollande for basically like, to mix metaphors, I guess, being asleep at the wheel of the twin engine. Mm-hmm. Like, people blame a lot of what Hollande did for why there's now this feeling in the rest of Europe that Merkel is in control of it all.
Yeah.
because he was kind of relatively uncharismatic or like a lame duck in comparison to her.
Yeah, I think weirdly, like, there hasn't been a lot of Macron news. And again, like, as you're saying, like, a year in review, there's kind of like, there's not a lot of crazy Macron stuff going down, but like, yeah, he hasn't been in power that long, and
yeah,
labor reforms in France are a big deal, and you spent, like, that was kind of one of his main things, and it seems to be just happening, and it's happening in a way that doesn't have the mass street protests you had when Hollande started talking about labor reforms. There are strikes and stuff going on, but it's not at the scale that you would have seen if you orchestrated it differently. His way of doing it seems to be like, we're doing stuff that we know won't be like broadly popular, but we think needs to be done, and we're going to try and do it in a way that people generally don't think is that objectionable. It's not like, he's not engaging in massive standoffs and stuff that becomes newsworthy around the world, but I think, like, within France, he's just kind of like getting some stuff done in a timely manner.
Yeah, so thank you for listening to all of our questions that we received and we answered to the best of our ability and for a very long period of time. We're sorry.
my voice is barely here.
We had fun, and if you ever have questions, again, feel free to send it in to us, and we'll probably do another questions episode like this whenever we need to go away for some reason and we need an episode to fill the gap and we can't cover the news.
Or if it's a slow news week and we need to slip some things in.
Yeah, so that's also a possibility.
Good.
So thanks again for listening. If you like the show, please contact us either in the email previouslyineurope@gmail.com, on our Twitter account @PrevInEurope. We have a Facebook group which you can find us on and chat to us directly or post things. We talk about the news there and stuff. It's fun. And lastly, we also have a website, previouslyineurope.eu, where you can listen to all the podcasts there and links to the various social medias. And if you feel so nice and inclined, if you subscribe to this podcast, that helps a lot. Or if you leave a rating, that also helps a lot.
So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Yes. Happy New Year again.
Happy New Year again.
This episode will actually come out in the new year. This is episode 1, 2018. But
you guys are from the future. What's it like?